Hey, I'm Jeff from Seattle. Bullseye with Jesse and Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me now. You should support the show like I just did. Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate. You won't regret it.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Starting with the state, moving on to Stella and their first movie, Wet Hot American Summer, my guests David Wayne and Michael Showalter have spent their careers making weird comedy and getting mixed reviews. And that wasn't, like, on purpose.
We sort of thought we had sold out a little bit.
Right.
It wasn't that we had, like, fully sold out, but it was like we've really, like, watered it down. You know, like, we really did. And so, you know, it was like we couldn't sell out even if we tried, because we tried. We tried really hard. And then those reviews, those first reviews came out about Stella, and it was like, this is the weirdest show ever.
It's Bullseye. Coming up, I'll talk to Wayne and Showalter about reviving Wet Hot American Summer for the small screen and pursuing a brand of comedy that isn't really like anything else.
I always felt, from the day I met everyone else in the state, that like there was like a cause here. And the cause was about something about comedy that meant something real to me. And I felt like throughout the failures, I never lost sight of that. I think this is a special sensibility and a special group of people that need to keep doing it.
Then later, Keith Powell from 30 Rock and the new series Keith Broke His Leg tells us about how he encountered a life-changing movie as a 12-year-old. While he was stocking video store shelves.
I walked in there one day and I said, you know, I would love to just watch a lot of your movies, but I don't have any money. And they're like, well, put this back on the shelf. And that became my job.
Plus, I'll tell you why you need to search out the new season of Andy Daly's TV show, Review with Forrest McNeil. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. In its opening weekend, the movie Wet Hot American Summer made $7,000. Roger Ebert hated it so much, he wrote a song about how much he hated it. And yet, 15 years later, I have invited the creators of Wet Hot American Summer to come on my show and talk about it. Why? Well, for one thing, it's been revived as a four-hour miniseries on Netflix. And for another, it is the best. Warm-hearted and completely insane and totally brilliant. It's kind of hard to describe. I could say it's like Meatballs. It's set at a summer camp in the early 80s. It's full of randy teenagers and bemused administrators, but it is way crazier than Meatballs. Every joke is perfectly logical in its complete commitment to absurdity. Every actor completely sincere in their intense fealty to dumbness. The film and series star Wayne, Showalter, Amy Poehler, Bradley Cooper, Michael Ian Black, Janine Garofalo, Paul Rudd, and a whole pile of other people. Here's a scene from the movie from 2001. The counselors are all together on the last day of camp, and they're thinking about their future.
You guys, I'm really going to miss this place.
Me too. Hey, let's all promise that in 10 years from today, we'll meet again. And we'll see what kind of people we've blossomed into.
Yeah!
What time you want to meet?
You mean 10 years from now?
Yeah.
Let's meet in the morning so we can make a day of it.
Okay, so what is it? Is it like 9 or 9:30?
Well, let's say 9. That way we can be here by 9:30.
Well, no, why don't we say 9:30 and then make it your beeswax to be here at 9:30? I mean, we're all going to be in our late 20s by then. I just don't see any reason why we can't be places on time.
Okay, then. It's settled. 9:30 it is. All agreed?
Great.
Yeah.
Great. Because I have something at 11.
Michael Showalter, David Wayne, welcome back to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
It's good to be here.
Great to be back.
So, Michael, I feel like you went into like a fugue state while that clip was playing. I saw you like close your eyes, bow your head.
Well, I don't want to reveal. But it's partly the geography of where we are right now. The black box.
Oh.
But I'm saying I don't want to, you know.
You can ruin the theater of the mind if you want to.
Yes.
I mean, people probably imagine this show taking place on a sort of grand Parisian opera stage.
Exactly.
Or Italian.
Exactly.
Not sure which.
The at the Strada. Is that a thing? The Strada?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The different European countries have different traditions of opera that are quite distinct from each other if you really look into it.
What's your favorite country's tradition?
Well, I mean, you could talk about, you know, for example, Vienna, there's the Italian opera.
Who are some of your favorite composers from Vienna, of the Vienna opera composers?
I love them all. They all have a very wonderful opera quality to them.
Well, what would just be one that you like?
I couldn't. They're just so great the way they do. Those composers are some of my favorites. I wouldn't, to single one out would be criminal, I think.
David, do you have a favorite song or aria?
So many.
From the world of
so
opera.
So many. Yeah.
What would just be one?
I wouldn't even want to do it. I have a lot of friends in the opera world and I don't want to insult any of them.
Like who? Who are your friends in the opera world?
Pavarotti, I guess.
Pavarotti.
That's all I can come up
right,
with.
That's an opera figure.
But yeah, the meditative state had a lot to do with that. This is just a very fuzzy little black box.
That's true.
Worthy of meditation, I thought.
So, David, the two of you wrote this movie together. David, you directed it. And one of the most distinctive things about the world of Wet Hot American Summer is a really specific tone. And I'm worried that I failed at describing that tone. So I wonder if the two of you could tell me, you know, sort of what you were imagining when you came up with the idea for the movie 15 years ago.
One thing that I remember, this is David speaking, is that when we talked about the idea for it in the very, very beginning, we were working on a different project that seemed like it was going to be hard. And then we were like, you know what else we should do? Camp. And then the one-liner that I feel like we talked about, and Mike maybe remember this differently, was it's camp, but funny in the way that we would make it funny, basically.
That seems like it's a tough sell to financiers.
You mean like it's sincere, but with jokes?
Well, I don't know if we went that far. Like, we were like, we know what we think is funny, and so we'll apply that to a summer camp story.
Right.
And I do think that that was a tough sell to financiers, which is why it was so incredibly hard to get it financed.
Michael Showalter, how would you describe it? Expand on sincere, but
yeah.
with jokes.
Well, the movies that we talked about a lot when we were writing the movie weren't so much some of the movies you would think that we would talk about, like Airplane or Blazing Saddles or
movies with 10,000 jokes in them that are spoofs.
Python movies. It was more American Graffiti, Dazed and Confused, Nashville.
Do the Right Thing.
Do the Right Thing.
Big, epic, ensemble, multi-protagonist dark comedies.
Yeah. So we were very interested in the characters and the ensemble moviness of it. And I think that the jokes, we had just come from doing The State. And so sketch comedy was what we knew. It was our voice was this kind of, you start with a premise and you just kind of build it out and go crazy with it. And so really, it was almost like what we were capable of, almost. It was like we were capable of telling these camp stories that we definitely had a genuine connection to in a heartfelt way. And then sort of on top of that, we also knew comedically how to kind of twist a premise and make it absurd in a way. And I think in terms of sensibility, that's still what I find funny. That silliness, that absurdity is still very much, in terms of comedy, is what I like the most.
Because you just listed, you know, five or six movies, none of which have almost any, like, total ridiculousness in them, which is pretty much in almost every second of Wet Hot American Summer, something completely ridiculous is happening.
Right.
What do you think is the difference between the ridiculousness of Airplane or a Mel Brooks movie and the ridiculousness of what the two of you guys have done?
I think that if you dissect it and quantify it, it's not that different. But I think that what makes it different is that it was true to us and what we found funny at that time and still do, I think. And you could go through and say, well, our proclivities are towards this kind of joke more than that kind of joke versus Zucker. But I think that it really is just a different variation of that kind of all, no rules type comedy voice.
I think we've even talked about this, which is the semiotic angle, which I couldn't define or has never been intentional.
Years ago, you, Michael Showalter, were on the show and we talked about the fact that you have a degree in semiotics.
Right. Well, supposedly.
The study of symbols and their meaning, basically.
I have no idea. But I do think, intentionally or not, there is this meta thing that we're doing. This deconstruction of the joke. Sometimes the joke isn't the joke, but that we did the joke. So that gets to this meta level of, for example, in the original movie, Coop slips on a banana peel. This leads to a bucket falling on his head, and et cetera, et cetera. And that very much is a the joke is, oh my God, I can't believe they did a joke about a guy slipping on a banana peel.
They did that joke.
You know, or in Stella, we there's a scene in Stella where we get out of a car in Stella the web shorts. We get out of the car and like we're not wearing pants or something. David,
right.
You know, and then we like,
yep.
And it's like all sped up. It's like we get out of the car and we realize, oh my God, none of us are wearing pants. And then we get back in the car and it's all sped up. And when we get back out, like we are, but they're on our head or something like that. But again, it's like the joke is how old school that joke is. Not so much that the joke itself is funny, but like it's almost like, you know, the joke is like, oh my God, I can't believe they did like that kind of a joke.
But those are jokes that you are not couching in the kind of ironic detachment that I think that people would expect.
Right.
From someone who is deconstructing.
No, it's coming from a love of it.
Yeah. And I mean in the TV show, in the series on Netflix, there's like a pretty straightforward like Benny Hill chase scene. My character Coop chases after a camper and, you know, he can't catch up to him and he's going in circles and the kid, you know, and that's just, you know, Benny Hill. That's any episode of Benny Hill where they are chasing the old guy around.
Let's play a clip from the new Netflix series of Wet Hot American Summer. And my guests are Michael Showalter and David Wayne, who created it. And this scene actually features Showalter and Wayne. So Michael Showalter plays Coop, and he's at the summer camp, and he finds his girlfriend Donna, who's played by Lake Bell, hanging out with a new camp staff member who we've just met, who's played by David Wayne. David Wayne is visiting from Israel to be the soccer counselor. And his name is Yaron.
Oh, my gosh. Can I have one of those? I've just been, like, dying for a cigarette.
Of course. You guys, you can't smoke at camp.
You're cute. Really miss these. They're not as strong in the States.
Well, I brought many, so anytime.
Be careful what you offer.
I'm Gerald Cooperberg. I'm Donna's boyfriend. Well, now for me, it's time for I have to play for teaching soccer for kids. And so see you soon.
Sababa.
Sababa.
Yeah, Saba. Ba. Donna, I can't believe you smoke now.
You should try it. You might like it, Coop.
Oh, I don't know.
Come on.
Okay.
You look sexy with the cigarette.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you want to, like, go have lunch or whatever?
I'm probably going to skip lunch just because I'm not really into the ersatz food thing.
Oh, yeah, right. Ersatz stuff in general is pretty dubious. It's kind of my take on that. Maybe we could then go back to my bunk and just, like, do whatever.
Coop, I don't know if I can just because I have to unpack and take things out of bags and stuff. I'm kind of slammed right now.
Yeah.
But I'll see you later.
Sure, yeah. You want to make a scheduled time for that?
Bye.
Bye.
Just hearing that in the context of this discussion, it does make me
well,
laugh.
Well, also funny, of course, Jesse Thorne would pick the ersatz moment to zero in on.
Right. But there, I would say what I think that clip does encapsulate quite a bit of the kinds of range of things we do. There's stuff in there that's like very weird and like you have to be – there's like what we call quiet jokes in there. And then there's some slightly more overt ones. And then there's actually a moment of, at the end, I think, of real, like, oh, poor Coop, you know. But, yeah.
When you wrote the script to Wet Hot American Summer and you showed it to people that were not from, you know, the, both of you had come out of a sketch comedy show on MTV called The State, which was, you know, in some ways an extraordinary success. I mean, it still is the marker of your careers and numerous other people's careers, but also a kind of small and distinctive thing in the context of MTV and culture generally. When you showed it to, like, movie producers or whatever, what did they make of it?
Some liked it and thought it was funny, like the producer that ended up producing the movie, Howard Bernstein. And a lot of times it was people who did know The State. But there was definitely, I think some people, as I recall, had a similar reaction to the script as some of the critics had to the movie when it came out, which was something of a befuddlement and don't know what to make of it and just like, you know, just didn't get it.
This isn't funny.
Did you realize you were making something that would be that polarizing?
Me, no. Not at all. And that's been true of everything. I, the three big sort of things that I've been associated with David, The State, Wet Hot, and Stella, all three kind of went through this same thing of some kind of like extreme negative reaction from the mainstream press. And then this very warm, loving response from the generation that we share.
And over time.
And in none of those situations was there ever any intent on any level to alienate anybody or thought that like, oh, this is like super subversive, you know.
I remember particularly – yeah, I remember when we were doing Stella, we were just like, now we're just doing something that's straight up funny, just like anybody can come and enjoy this. It doesn't feel like we're hitting something to the left, but clearly we were.
Let's just say I'm laughing out of a fondness for Stella rather than the transparent truth, which is I'm laughing that Stella's like one of the weirdest, most specific television shows that ever made it to television.
I know.
Which I'm ultimately so proud of.
Here's a scene from Stella, the Comedy Central show, starring my guests David Wayne and Michael Showalter, along with Michael Ian Black. David and the Michaels play three suit-wearing friends, roommates. I don't know. It's a little hard to describe their relationship.
There's no easy way to say this, guys. We're broke.
Broke, but that's impossible.
It's true. If we don't start adjusting our budget soon, we're going to be like the proverbial light bulb.
Screwed. Where are we possibly going to cut back on stuff, you know?
Well, I mean, like, for example, Black, $98 for new swim flippers? What was wrong with the swim flippers you got last summer?
Look at them, David. I'd be the laughingstock of the aquatic center. They're hopelessly out of fashion.
They are, David. Besides, what are you, beyond reproach? I mean, what about all that surgical gauze you bought?
That was for my appendectomy, Mike.
David, that appendectomy was cosmetic, and you know
it. Was not.
Was not. Fuzzy, wuzzy, wuzz of air.
Fuzzy?
I don't know.
You guys, while you were arguing, I was coming up with a list of ideas about how we can save some money.
I'll be the judge of that. No. Here, grow our own vegetables.
Hey, that's a great idea. We could save $10 a month. That's $50 a year.
Imagine never having to worry about money again.
Let's do it.
Let's grow our own vegetables.
Yay!
When Stella made it onto television, when it became a Comedy Central show after it had been for years a live stage show and series of short films that the three of you had done along with Michael Ian Black, I remember thinking, huh, a television show, huh?
So did the world.
But I think, I think for me, like, the stuff that I'd grown up loving and seemed popular was, you know, early Steve Martin stuff and early Woody Allen stuff and Monty Python and National Lampoon. And that stuff seemed out there and crazy and silly to me, too. So as to why it seemed, you know, Kentucky Fried Movie or like there's these things that I was very obsessed with as a kid that seemed popular, that what we were doing didn't seem so far off from, or it seemed in the same, but it was, you know, maybe like the world had changed or something. Like, it didn't seem like, you know, you go watch Life of Brian. That's a weird movie. That's a weird movie. Also, Meaning of Life, that's a weird movie. But people love
John Hughes movies even broke the fourth wall and were doing weird jokes and Long Duck Dong. And like, you know, there's a lot going on that you don't remember.
Yeah. And so maybe just like, I don't know, like maybe the world had changed and we didn't know it or something.
I'll finish my conversation with David Wayne and Michael Showalter after a break. We'll try to find out what it was about summer camp that inspired them. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR. Bullseye is brought to you in part by Simple, banking for people who like to be treated like people. You'll never get hit with overdraft or monthly fees, and you can create goals and start saving automatically a little each day. You can visit simple.com/bullseye to see the way banking should be. Hey, if you enjoy Bullseye, you'll love NPR's Planet Money. It's full of funny, insightful stories about how the world works, like why we work so much. Plus, useful stuff like the messed up economics of drought and the psychology of a big red button. Find Planet Money now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to David Wayne and Michael Showalter. Their new TV series, Wet Hot American Summer, First Day of Camp, is available to stream now. I imagine that when you were doing The State on MTV, most of the people who were paying attention to you, like most of the reaction you got was probably from people who liked it. Because, you know, it was not a mainstream enough thing that people were writing you letters telling you how much you stunk. That may or may not be the case. But...
Well, other than the initial reviews that came out of The State, which were truly hostile, just like the Wet Hot.
The first round of reviews, the first round of reviews to The State were as negative as any reviews we've ever gotten. Just the same thing. Who do these people think they are? How dare they try to make a joke? You know, how did... And for our
so terrible, I wanted to kill myself.
Yeah,
you know?
That was our second season that we had on the show. Our promos for our second season was us walking down a country road, kicking stones and empty cans, as our negative reviews were scrolling on the screen and acting all mopey. And you know, and then what was the tagline? Do you remember?
The tagline was "The State More Miserable."
Yeah,
you know, because coming, more new episodes starting soon.
Yeah, more miserable. Because one of the reviews called it miserable, and so it was the second season was more miserable.
What was it?
One of them was so terrible it deserves to be studied.
But then that show became popular. I mean, that show wasn't even that show. The State actually, by the time we
lasted just long enough to actually do well get acceptance.
It was popular.
What did it feel like when this movie that was such a labor of love came into movie theaters and, you know, as I said, I read Roger Ebert's review earlier today, which is in the form of a set of lyrics to the song Hello Mudda, Hello Fada. And it couldn't be more
mean.
Yeah, it is horrible. It is brutal.
It's mean.
And this from probably the great film critic of American history most friendly to comedy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at the time, too, at the time, it really mattered what Roger Ebert said.
Right.
It
right.
wasn't now where there's so many different ways.
And no dominant critic at all.
You know, there are the major ones, but then there's all the great blogs and the web magazines and all this stuff that are all writing reviews. At that time, there was like the New York Times, Chicago Sun-Times, and like one or two other things. And that was what you had to go on. And Roger Ebert.
Well, and specifically Ebert and Roper was like, did it get two thumbs up or what?
You know? Oh, my God.
And they both gave it two thumbs down big time.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And I remember the disdain. I think I have it on my website of their video review on their TV show. It's just like, and then something about a can of beans or something. It's just stupid.
What I remember was like, why are you reviewing it? Like, why, if you hated it so much, why are you, if that was part of my reaction was like, so we're in like 15 movie theaters. The movie couldn't have had a smaller release. It wasn't like we were, you know, in every movie theater across the country. And so naturally we're going to review it. It was tiny. It was tiny. Why are you reviewing this movie that has no chance anyway, only to kick it so hard in the mouth? And David and I definitely are – David has a really good attitude about reviews and stuff. I find that stuff devastating. It's the meanness of it. It's not – my problem isn't the feeling outraged. How could someone not like something? It's not that. It's the mean-spiritedness of it. It's the, wow, you really sat down and took the time to like get creative about how nasty you were going to be about this movie that was made – this is the crushing part, with so much joy and love and hope and all these good things. And like, and then you just kind of stomp all over it. It sucks.
And to me, I take exactly what you said as a positive. Like, they took the time and effort and gave us the attention. You know, so the whole thing of count the inches. And I guess I feel like they're paying attention, so that there's something to that. And I know that there were also champions of the movie when it first came out too. Right away. I mean, Owen Gleiberman at Entertainment Weekly gave it this glowing, glowing review. And there were others that even pointed out, like, why is it getting such a dumpy release? And why is it being hidden on the top floor attic of the 45-plex on Times Square? You know, and as with anything in the world, there's always, you can always find every opinion. So it's kind of take it with a grain of salt.
I think had I not happened to have read a review in the AV Club rather than the, you know, the review in the Chicago Sun-Times or the New York Times or something like that, I might have been one of the, you know, thousands upon thousands of people who saw it 5 years later or 7 years later, rather than having seen it. I mean, it was not in any theaters in Santa Cruz, California, where I was in college at the time. But I saw it shortly after its video release. For that reason, it seemed like there was a couple people who understood this very odd tone that you had created, or very specific tone, I should say.
Yeah. Again, I mean, it wasn't that odd tone for me. It wasn't so odd. It didn't seem so odd. It seemed, and for the cast too, for the group of people that, you know, for obviously for the state people, this was our common vernacular, but for people like Amy Poehler and Paul and Janine and, they were right on board too. Like, they fell right into it.
As did David Hyde Pierce people who were not even part of this at all. I mean, yeah. I think I've talked to David Hyde Pierce about this recently, and he was just saying that he felt like it was just, it was written with a certain specificity and confidence that he knew that if we were going to execute it with a serious lens on it, that, that it would really work and be really funny. And I think that I agree with Mike. Like, it didn't seem like we were doing something so off the charts. It just seemed like we were doing what we felt was funny.
When it came out and was roundly panned by most critics, didn't make a lot of money, did you then feel like it was a failure?
It stung. It stung pretty bad, yeah.
It definitely put Mike and I into a dark period in our careers, where we had certain champions in Hollywood that had seen it and responded to it and brought us in for meetings and stuff, but nobody really was interested in doing something like Wet Hot again, you know, particularly because it was such a failure. And it was just a tough, you know, we were trying to see if there was any life left in the movie for a while, and then that seemed to be a dead end, and then we were developing other things, and they, a lot of different areas, TV, movies, and nothing really came about, one of which was They Came Together, which took 10 years to get made, or 12 years. And so, yeah, it was rough, and the ramifications were real for the when it failed, you know. And it, for me personally, it was, I made the least amount of money and was struggling to figure out how I'm going to survive during that period.
I mean, we were doing Stella. I mean, at that,
that's right.
It didn't end our desire to continue to develop our comedic point of view, because really what the next big thing after that was Stella. And so we were doing our live show and our videos and getting and creating that whole world. But again, I mean, yeah, it really, really, it is devastating when you think you've done something good and you feel that you've accomplished, that you've sort of done the thing you set out to do. I mean, if we had not made the movie we wanted to make, I would be the first person to say that. But we felt like we had made the movie that we wanted to make. So to have people rejected in such harsh way on a personal level is very, very it stings. It stings. And although, it sort of hardens you to the business that you've chosen. It makes me – it sort of creates this kind of, you know, distrust or this sort of this feeling that, like, you know, that you're trying to protect something because you don't want to get hurt. You don't want to get hurt again.
To me, though, for me, and I think, we, as Mike said, we might differ on this. The big goal, the prize was, can we make this movie and pull it off and make it the movie that we want to make? And I feel like we did. And then for the audiences that, even from moment one, certain audiences were loving it. And I think that, to me, that was the win. And the fact that it then got a theatrical release, which was in absolutely no way a guarantee for an independent film, was also like, that to me was the benchmark. Like, it came out, it played in a movie theater in New York City. The New York Times reviewed it. Like, that was sort of the goal that I had in my head. And that happened. And nothing beyond that happened. And that sucked. But I was psyched that we'd hit that mark and then we could move on to the next
one. I had very grandiose goals. I had a very grandiose idea of that it would become Animal House. Like, you know, when we were making the movie, I had this feeling like, this is going to be Animal House, or this is going to be, you know, Caddyshack. Like, we're doing our that. Because those movies were everything to me growing. You know, the idea that if I could ever create something that could mean as much to someone else as those movies meant to me, then that was what I was chasing. So when it didn't even come close to that, it was just this crushing disappointment of like, yeah, you know, wow, I really misread that. I thought we were doing, and then what does that mean? That way, I thought it was this and it wasn't that. It's very disorienting.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Let's hear another clip from Wet Hot American Summer, First Day of Camp, my guest's new Netflix series. In this clip, you'll hear the Camp Firewood Theater Program rehearsing their play, Electro City. Well, their musical. Susie and Ben, played by Amy Poehler and Bradley Cooper, respectively, run the drama program at camp.
Electric nights,
electric days,
electric eyes,
electric waves.
Bravissimo. People, that is how it's done. Becky, Danny, I hope you're paying attention.
You guys are our leads. We need to feel the love between you.
It's called acting.
Yes, Ben, but it's a little more complicated than that. We never want to know you're acting. You have to be it so we don't see it. You have to live it or we won't forgive it. You have to inhabit it or leave it in the cabinet.
Hiya. Sorry I'm late. Guy jumped in front of the F train.
Everyone, this is my assistant, Rhonda. She's coming from the city to help us out tonight. She's going to teach you the new choreography.
All right. This one's with a hitch kick, right, into a ball change. Don't let your ball change look like a box step, and your grapevine needs to travel. Huh? You got that?
She's sassy.
From the top, guys, I want pizzazz. I want oomph. I want hips, hips, hips. Energy, okay? From one, no marking. 5, 6, 7, 8.
Electric night.
Stop. Stop moving.
What things about your own teenage years were you thinking about when you set up this film?
I mean, you know, camp is where you, like, kiss, you know, have your first. It's all the firsts happen at camp. You know, it's where you get your first girlfriend. It's where you get your first crush. It's where you get that first taste of what it's like to be independent and be on your own and make rules for yourself. And then also the big theme, too, of being who you are.
Also meet people that are your lifelong friends in many cases.
And you get to kind of break out of whatever that you've been defined as, whatever at home, you know, something happened in first grade and it's like who you are for the rest of your life, kind of. Whereas at camp, you get to kind of say, this is who I am. I'm a theater guy or whatever. And, you know, the cliche of like then the kid comes back in first day of eighth grade and it's like, whoa, what happened to so-and-so. Oh, well, they went to camp and, like, listened to Led Zeppelin for the first time. And, like, all of a sudden they've got long hair and whatever. It's kind of that kind of thing.
The other thing about camp to me is that it is so naturally and inherently heightened because it's like having a sleepover with all of your friends every night all summer. And so, so much can happen because you don't, you're never separated from everybody you know. So all of the drama of who likes who and friends and it all just happens in crazy record time, which is one of the reasons why I felt like setting it all in one single day was so natural to the nature of what it actually feels like in real life to go to summer camp.
Michael, did you ever change yourself to be a different person in camp than you were during the school year?
I only in that I think I felt more comfortable being like artier, like more doing musicals and performing and being more into singing. Like I love musical theater and I think I felt more like it was okay to do that. And not that it wasn't okay to do that where I'm from. It just wasn't going on. There was no sitting around singing Billy Joel songs happening in Princeton, New Jersey, which is where I grew up.
What about you, David?
I felt like I was very much like Coop at camp, but I was definitely, I wasn't so popular, but I was a notch more popular than I was in the world of my school. And so I was a little bit more like, and with that obviously comes confidence and, you know, bravado. And I had a little bit more swagger at camp than I did at home.
I like that. I like the idea of just one notch up, like not full, yeah. But
let's not go crazy.
Michael, what's your most distinct memory about camp, like specific memory?
I mean, there's like the first kiss stuff, you know, but for me, it was the musicals. It was being in musicals. It was we did Bye Bye Birdie. We did Oliver. We did.
What was your best role?
Well, I famously played Fagin in Oliver.
Sure. Let's talk about something that the whole audience hasn't already heard about over and over and over.
I was 10 years old playing Fagin, who's like in his mid-80s. And I've since gone and looked at the book and like he's described in the Dickens novel as like disgusting to look at. So I'd say like putting on shows in the barn, that's the stuff that like I just think – and dances. That was another big one. Every Friday night.
Oh, God, yeah.
Every Friday night there was a dance in the barn. And the big slow song was Wild Horses, Rolling Stones. And, you know, playing on records and you'd hear Rolling Stones come on. And it's like, oh, you got to go ask – you know, that's where you like make your move.
Slow dance.
That was terrifying to me.
Oh, yeah.
The song in question for me was Hero by Mariah Carey. And, yeah, I mean, I don't think there was anything more terrifying in my entire life than that.
Yeah. What did you go to camp?
I went to an Episcopal camp in California called St. Dorothy's Rest.
Wow.
And I remember very vividly for some reason, you know, you had to go to church on Sunday.
Yeah.
And I remember that one of the times you went to church, for some reason, maybe if you were like the best cabin, you were allowed to go to church in your pajamas in your sleeping bag. That was the peak achievement at St. Dorothy's Rest.
Yes.
The slow song at our camp was a lot of times Stairway to Heaven. And so it was always this awkward moment when Stairway to Heaven ramps up and turns more into a rocker. And you're like, oh, do we stop now in the middle
right.
of the song?
Do we stop slow dancing and like kind of speed it up a little bit?
Yeah.
Then you like
break apart.
Well, you like stay holding hands, right? But you just kind of like you break apart, but you're still kind of holding hands and like doing a jig for a little while.
I always remember at the dance, there was always halfway through the dance, someone would be like storm into the room and be like, Eric just broke up with me.
Another big one was Rock Lobster. Like when you know the B-52 song,
not
Rock
a slow
Lobster.
Dance song.
No, but like it would be like everyone. And then you like when it get down and then you get on your back and you like. Do the Rock Lobster and like, you know, you've got like 50 kids like squirming around on the floor like doing Rock Lobster. It's pretty fun.
I was famous at my camp for being associated with the song My Sharona, which was my favorite song. And I used to play it all the time. And then the big thing was like during the talent show, I would always do a fake out and come out and do what seemed like some other act I was going to do, but then suddenly My Sharona would come on and it would turn into a My Sharona dance lip sync thing.
He's going to do
Yay!
It.
Yay! He did it. He did it.
Yeah.
Do either of the two of you remember anyone in particular that you slow danced with or were too scared to slow dance with?
There was this one girl. I won't say her name because I don't know, but she was kind enough to dance with me when I couldn't. Like, she was really nice, and I remember she saw that I didn't have anyone else to dance with. She was a counselor. I was a camper. And she was, like, twice my height. Her first name was Lisa. And I remember being very, very grateful to her for not letting me just hang out with no one to slow dance to.
I remember the first time I slow danced was actually in middle school, I think. But this girl who I'd never met before said, hey, do you want to dance? And I was like, yeah. And we went out in the middle and both of us were sweating and shaking the whole time. The end.
Did you make out at camp?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Oh, yeah. Lots of making out.
Sure. Tons sure. of making out. French kiss for the first time.
I did everything for my first time at camp.
Not me. No. There was heavy petting, but no home runs were hit. But David, apparently you hit many home runs. You
were nobody's inviting me to.
You were like Babe.
Elaborate, so I'm not
you were like Babe Ruth.
I'm waiting patiently for you to elaborate, David.
You were like the Babe Ruth of summer camp hookups.
My second last summer at camp, when I was a junior counselor, which we called an apprentice at my camp, I was dating an actual counselor who was 2 years older than me, and it was very secret and very exciting and salacious. And neither of us had hit a home run yet, and so we both made a big plan, and like a week later, we did it. And it was very exciting.
I don't think I ever made out at camp.
At Mary's?
At St. Dorothy's Rest.
St. Dorothy's Rest.
Yeah.
Was it a co-ed situation?
We went to the state fair.
So there were girls.
You
came
girls
in contact with
there.
Girls at the state fair.
Yeah.
And did you go to camp in the 1930s?
Yes. Yes.
Like, I'm imagining you
wearing, like, one of those scarves you tie around, like a Boy Scout.
Yeah, or you, like, carry all your books in a little belt and, like, the book belt and, like.
You may have an odd picture of my childhood, Michael.
But, I mean, it fits your personality.
But you're saying,
Jesse,
like, you met
bit.
Girls at the state
fair.
It was fair
1990. And I mean, I already mentioned Mariah
that's
Carey.
That's true. It wasn't it wasn't like Benny Goodman came to my camp one summer.
I didn't go to camp to flee the Dust Bowl, if that's what you're asking.
It sounds like that, though, a little bit.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to Michael Showalter and David Wayne. Here's another scene from Wet Hot American Summer, first day of camp. Katie, played by Marguerite Moreau, has a boyfriend at the preppy camp across the lake, but her fellow counselor, played by Paul Rudd, has had his eye on her. So here are the two prospective lovebirds as Katie's preppy boyfriend watches from afar through binoculars.
Who are you making your friendship bracelet for, Katie?
Oh, I'm making a boyfriendship bracelet for my boyfriend Blake from Camp Tiger Claw. We've been to second base twice, so that adds up to fourth, and he is so good at lacrosse.
I thought I heard my name.
No.
Hey, your bones look all jacked out, Katie. Let me fix them. That no good two-timing harlot.
Oh, let me see, Blake.
Oh, textbook nymphomania.
I knew it! Doesn't he know that caviar and corn dogs don't mix?
You don't touch a Tiger Claw man's girl and expect to get away with it!
I want to ask one kind of stupid question, if I could. In Wet Hot American Summer, the
Why
film...
Why stop now? Thank you.
How about I'd like to ask an entire interview's worth of stupid questions?
I don't feel I need to ask permission for that. Wet Hot American Summer has a very explicit gay sex scene between Michael Ian Black and Bradley Cooper.
Don't recall this, but go on.
I think I was trying to think, and I think maybe in high school I saw a movie where Leonardo DiCaprio was Oscar Wilde? Does that seem like something?
Or is it Van Gogh? He's in something
where Leonardo DiCaprio engaged in gay sex in the movie. But this was like an art house movie.
This was Titanic, James Cameron.
Right. And
Basketball Diaries with Mark Wahlberg.
I wonder if, like, what? It's a great scene. I wonder what led you to decide, oh, you know what we should have in this movie? Explicit gay sex scene.
It's a very straightforward joke, which is every one of those movies has the let's get so-and-so laid thing. You know, the like horny guys who recognize that one of their buddies needs to get laid, and so they make it their mission to get him laid. And so that's the trope that we were riffing off of. And then the joke is that not only is he getting laid, but he's getting laid all the time. And the quality of the sex is better than any like sort of like, you know.
It's like borderline elegant. Like it's like top drawer.
Yes. Like basically like not only is he getting laid, but he's like he's got a rich and fulfilling sex life with this
and it's
guy.
But by design, it was the only coupling in the movie that had any real heat to it and any real meat to it. And that wasn't just bubblegum making out.
Yeah. I mean, and then the irony is basically.
And then they get married.
He has the – McKinley is got the last laugh. And then they get married and it's a beautiful ceremony and all of that stuff.
But they're the ones who actually have love.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly.
Well, Michael Showalter, David Wayne – so great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
Michael Showalter and David Wayne are the co-creators of Wet Hot American Summer. The new prequel series of Wet Hot American Summer is on Netflix now. Coming up after a break, Keith Powell from 30 Rock and the new series Keith Broke His Leg tells us about how he encountered a life-changing movie as a 12-year-old while he was stocking video store shelves. Child labor news on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Bullseye is brought to you in part by Simple, banking for people who like to be treated like people. You'll never get hit with overdraft or monthly fees, and you can create goals and start saving automatically a little each day. You can visit simple.com/bullseye to see the way banking should be. Hey, if you enjoy Bullseye, you'll love NPR's Planet Money. It's full of funny, insightful stories about how the world works, like why we work so much. Plus, useful stuff like the messed up economics of drought and the psychology of a big red button. Find Planet Money now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Artists, you know, people that make stuff, are always influenced by the work of others. And sometimes something an artist sees is so good, so perfect, that they wish they'd made it themselves. Happens so often to people that we talk to that we made it a segment. It's called I Wish I'd Made That. You're about to hear from the actor and director Keith Powell, who you probably know best as Topher from the NBC sitcom 30 Rock.
Come on, Sue. You can't just leave me here with Topher.
Actually, I'm off, Liz. With my degree, I can always go into architecture or medical nanotechnology.
Wait, what did you major in?
Sorry, I don't understand. Oh, I see. At Harvard, we call them concentrations.
There's something that Keith wishes he'd made. The 1976 movie written by Paddy Chayefsky and directed by Sidney Lumet.
I'm going to talk about one of my favorite movies of all time, Network.
This story is about Howard Beale, who was the network news anchorman on UBS TV.
In his time, Howard Beale had been a mandarin of television, the grand old man of news with a hot rating of 16 and a 28 audience share. In 1969, however, his fortunes began to decline. He fell to a 22 share. The following year, his wife died, and he was left a childless widower with an 8 rating and a 12 share. He became morose and isolated, began to drink heavily, and on September 22nd, 1975, he was fired, effective in 2 weeks.
Network is a movie about a fictional television network, a hybrid of NBC, CBS, and ABC, struggling with poor ratings, and a newscaster announces live on the air that he is going to commit suicide on air, and then comedy ensues.
Because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Because the only truth you know is what you get over this tube. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube is the gospel, the ultimate revelation.
The first time I saw Network, I would say that I was about 11 or 12. I was working in a video store specifically so that I could see movies for free. I walked in there one day and I said, you know, I would love to just watch a lot of your movies, but I don't have any money. And they're like, well, put this back on the shelf. And that became my job. And it started out with all the stuff that, you know, everybody sees, like Jaws and, you know, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and not just Steven Spielberg. Let me think something else, you know, Last Picture Show, films that are in the American canon that, as a 12-year-old, I might not have seen. But then I started spiraling into, you know, Kurosawa films, classic movies that we think are classic today, but you would have, like, no 12-year-old has business really seeing. I saw them all. It was great. And one of them that I put back on the shelf once was Network. What I really loved about it was a lot of speeches. The most famous speech in the movie is the "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore" speech. And that's when Howard Beale, who is the star of the nightly newscast, who's been told that his ratings are going bad, and he goes crazy.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!"
The anchorman's announcement transforms a tabloid-esque news show into a ratings phenomenon.
What makes the speech so raw and honest, and which I think is accessible to a kid and to an adult, is he has been told that all of his work means nothing. There is a screw it moment where he's just like, I'm now going to just say what's on my mind. And it's very freeing. The speech is very freeing. So that's why it's such an emotional thing, because he finally just decides, I don't care what other people think of me. I'm just going to be me. But as a kid, when you watch that, you see that he's rewarded for being himself. And when you are an adolescent trying to develop your personality, it's rewarding to see someone just finally say, I know my thoughts are crazy, but I'm going to say them, because it allows you to be yourself.
This is not a psychotic episode. This is a cleansing moment of clarity.
Subsequently, a couple years later, I was a freshman at New York University, and I saw that a movie theater was playing it. I see it emotionally as an adult, as giving your whole life to something and being told it's not good enough, and finally saying, I don't care if it's not good enough for you. I'm not playing by your rules anymore. I need to play by my rules, and I need to do things that are fulfilling for me.
So if you want the truth, go to God. Go to your gurus. Go to yourselves, because that's the only place you're ever going to find any real truth. But man, you're never going to get any truth from us.
It completely changed my life. It informed everything that I am as an artist today. When I took on 30 Rock, my approach to the character of Topher was that he was not a joke. You know, the joke of the character is he's a black guy and a Harvard guy. And with him, you get two for the price of one. But it was very important to me that Topher is never aware of his affirmative action joke. That Topher doesn't get what makes him a unicorn in the comedy writing world. That he just lives very naturally. I think that in many ways, the movie network kind of informed that, because it's very much these people who are not aware of what the joke is. Network taught me that the circumstances that all the characters are in can be the humor. And if you just very much live honestly within that world, you have something that's very compelling on many levels that hits your funny bone, but also you emotionally connect to. That's the work that I want to do in my life. And I feel like the rest of my life and career has been modeled off of finding the humor and also the very human emotions within a scene that can happen simultaneously. And when I saw that as a 18-year-old, it showed me what was possible in art that I had not seen before.
Keith Powell on the thing he wishes he'd made, the 1976 satire Network. Keith Powell is an actor and director. His new web series is called Keith Broke His Leg. Every week, we like to close the show with a recommendation from me, your host. It's the Outshot. How low can Forrest McNeil go? It's the question that Review with Forrest McNeil, Andy Daly's strange and wonderful Comedy Central series, asks. Daly plays McNeil, who is a reviewer of life experiences, like having a best friend or getting a divorce, stealing, which is an odd premise, but it is not nearly as odd as the show. Review, it turns out, is half character study, half torture session.
McNeil, where are you? What can we do to help?
Shoot the tiger! Oh,
stand back!
Andy Daly's greatest gift as a performer is a sincere and pervasive geniality. Like, imagine a small-town pharmacist in a Norman Rockwell painting. He's blonde, handsome, he's kind of gentle-looking. His resting state is a kind of smiling incredulity. What? No. You see guys like that, just sort of genial white guys, playing proud, dumb doofuses a lot. You know, like the people Fred Willard or Will Ferrell play. Daly takes it another direction. He almost always goes dark, usually in one of two ways. Either his character gives us a sort of gentle, friendly recitation of the unspeakable acts of evil he's committed in the past, or Daly picks up this genial everyman character and drops him into just a carnival of pain and humiliation. Review is the latter type, the carnival of pain and humiliation. Sometimes it's big things. Orgies gone wrong. Car accidents. General friendlessness. Sometimes it's smaller things, like eating pancakes.
That's the profound life experience he wants to know about eating 15 pancakes.
That's his request, so.
Yes, that is the request that has been made. Okay.
Review is such a perfect character study that the little things, like the pancakes, are actually even more compelling than the big ones.
Three pancakes in, and I already feel that I have greatly overindulged. I am full of pancakes. Any rational person feeling the way I do now would definitely stop.
Every one of the reviews forces Forrest into horrible life choices. And then it forces him to stew in the consequences.
His blood feels very slow.
Oh, God.
I have now eaten 10 pancakes. And on the bright side, I can see the light at the end of this disgusting tunnel, but it has now been 45 minutes since I started eating, and the pancakes are no longer hot.
These aren't food.
With 1.5 pancakes to go, I had hit a wall. My producer, Grant, made the unprecedented move of stepping out from behind the cameras to provide much-needed moral support.
Hey, you know you gotta finish these pancakes, right?
Yeah.
It's telling that Forrest McNeil wears the same tan blazer every day in every scene of the show. Review is about the tension between these huge, crazy life choices that he's making. Becoming a racist, making a sex tape, getting addicted to drugs on purpose. And a tough truth. We are who we are. Despite what our self-help culture tells us, we can't change our essential character with one big decision. There's no replacement on the outside for changing what's on the inside. Not even eating 15 pancakes.
As I left the restaurant, I scanned my soul for some greater wisdom to share with humanity.
Yeah, there's not really a whole lot more to say about that. It was extremely unpleasant and should be avoided at all costs. Eating 15 pancakes, half a star.
That's my outshot. We've come to the end of another episode of Bullseye. The show's produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer's Julia Smith. Production fellow at Maximum Fun is Abadianex Perello. Senior producer is Colin Anderson. All our interstitial music provided by Dan Wally. Thanks to the Go team and their label Memphis Industries for our theme music. Thanks this week to Neil Rauch at NPR New York for engineering help. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, they are all free. Just go to MaximumFun.org or search for Bullseye in whatever you like to use to listen to podcasts. And you should totally check out our sister podcast, Pop Rocket. It's sort of like this one, but chattier. It's a roundtable discussion of everything that's great in popular culture, hosted by Guy Branum, who is a brilliant culture critic and comedian. This week, tattoos and nerd culture. Find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts. Listening is the only way you will find out exactly what tattoos every single one of the personalities on the show has. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.